Welcome to the first episode of Casterly Talk. I'm Ken Napsuk, and it's time to get down and deep and a little dirty, definitely sweaty, about Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire, everything about this wonderful world show, series of books, series of encyclopedias and research books, and fan fictions, costumes, anything you want, and I could not do it without the man who actually created the name of this show, Lon Harris.
Yes, Casterly Talk. I came up with a list of Game of Thrones puns. It's probably 30 items long. Most terrible. I don't have it in front of me.
I wish I had that. And that was when we were over at, Screen Junkies.
Yes.
We were doing Watching Thrones.
We were going to do that. Before we decided on calling it, I never liked, a certain person we don't have to discuss, liked the branding of, like, verb show.
verb show.
Hacking Mr. Robot, Watching Thrones, knocking dead. I was never a big fan of this.
No, me either. And I get from a, if you're flipping through, and this was initially on Plus, this last season you guys moved it to Screen Junkies News, I believe. So if you're flipping through the thumbnails and you get a quick shot of Watching Thrones, oh, that seems like a Game of Thrones. I get that. But what fun it is to name it something a little bit more creative.
Yeah, have a little fun. There's so, the great thing about Game of Thrones, such a rich world.
Yeah.
So many pun opportunities. All you do is you just think of like one thing that exists in that world, and then you just start spinning off, like I'll do one right now, like oysters, clams, and cockles. That's a thing. So you could do oysters, clams, and tockles, and now you have a podcast.
Now you have a podcast.
That one's specifically about Bravos culture.
It's a Bravosi podcast. And I think that's one of your superhero skills, is just coming up with names, titles, puns.
Sure.
It would be like, Get Lawn. It'd be like, that'd be the documentary. Get Lawn for puns.
Well, that's my process. You've just figured it out. You come up with, what are the terms, what are the things that are memorable from that thing, and then you just start spinning out the rhymes.
Oh, I like that. See, I always thought, I shoot for the puns first, and I think I need to find what's real first.
So this, I'm sure, one of the things I came up with was, I was going through all the names of all the properties. So like Highgarden and Winterfell and King's Landing and blah, 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 blah. Sunspear. And then get Casterly Rock, Casterly Talk. I also love Casterly Rock because we really haven't ever spent any time there.
We didn't. I mean, finally, season seven, we get a glimpse. Just a glimpse.
Really a moment.
A little brief moment. But yeah, Casterly Talk it is. I think there was our short list of names for that show.
Sure, yeah.
It got tossed out. Watching Thrones was born, and hey, that was great fun the first season, and then last season, Spencer Michelle Roth and others stepped in. I know you were on that show a lot, too. But Casterly Talk is here. It's now, and I reached out to Lon, said, number one, can I use the name? Number two, can you come along for the ride? So even though this is the pilot episode, as we develop Casterly Talk, hopefully I want to do it monthly, and maybe even more. We'll see where it goes. Lon Harris, Mr. Research, will be here with us there. And I want to start there, Lon, as we look into the show about why this worked. Why do we think this show, this property, caught on in 2011 in such a way and became this thing?
It's crazy now to think about. I've never read the books. I didn't go back with this property. I'd heard of it because I worked at bookstores.
Sure.
So I was like, oh, Game of Thrones. I know that that's a series.
High concept fantasy. Got it.
Well, in the same way that, like, I think of Wheel of Time That's a series I haven't read. I'm aware of it. I know that it's very long and that there's lots of them.
There's like 20.
You could make a show out of it, theoretically.
And it's been optioned, and that might be the next show we have to do.
They're going to try, for sure, at this point. But now, looking back, knowing what I know about it, it seems like this is too complicated. It seems like every meeting Benioff and Weiss would have, tower executives, not like, well, you can't do it. There's too much, you need too much background information to understand what is happening. And that was kind of my thought about the show early on in season one, like the first four or five episodes.
Were you lost?
I was. And I even sort of debated, like, well, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe it's too. And I like fantasy. I Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
Grew up with that. So I was interested right away. But yeah, it is. It's very dense. And I do think that they had a tough time, sort of the first half of season one, bringing you up, because things have to be happening in the show.
Right.
But they also have to be like, well, but this is what the Hand of the King does. This is where Winterfell is, and this is what's different between the North and King's Landing. And we're like, oh, okay. You know, like, you have to kind of pause every 5 minutes and be like, okay. Well, that's like, the Targaryens used to be in Westeros, but now they got kicked out, and now they're in Essos. Like, okay, Essos is this other continent. And it doesn't kind of...
A whole other show, yeah.
Yeah, it sort of drags down the storytelling a little bit in the beginning, but overall, I think they did a remarkable job. And that, to me, is what really, the fun of Game of Thrones, beyond the individual characters and performances being great, the effects being great, the action, all the little things you could pick out and praise about the show. To me, what I think the number one thing is that they've managed to do is really tell you the whole history of this alternate fantasy world and make it feel really real and make it feel really in depth and make it feel interesting and like it exists outside the margins of the show.
Yeah, and you can connect with things that you want that are real world, you know? I've had some people, you know, believe the White Walkers and the coming of the Night King means one certain thing, and another person has another opinion on it. And then, but you can also get lost in what you're saying, this world that George R. Martin has done such a wonderful, genius level job of creating. He's a special kind of egg.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's because there's people who are great writers and they're great at creating stories or characters that are memorable and meaningful. But then there's this other ability to create this whole alternate reality that nonetheless feels similar to our own, recognizable, but different and interesting enough that you want to keep learning more about the differences between their world and our world. And I think that's what makes the show fun to keep going back to, is that, you know, you're exploring all of these abstract ideas, and there's so many of them, and they're coming at you so fast. And once you do start to feel like familiar with it, it's very satisfying.
Oh yeah, it's like a little, once you're like, you know, Westerosi history more than almost real world history. It's a crowning achievement in your nerd life.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, this show more than any other. And I mean, I think on some level, and I don't want to distract us too much, but like every fandom. That's part of the appeal, is that if you dig really into the fandom, you start to see all these little connections that people who don't know the fandom as well don't see. Right. And I think that Game of Thrones is particularly good, maybe more so than other franchises, especially recently. I think like part of what the Star Wars franchise is going through right now is that people want that and they don't feel like they have it as much.
Right. It's this big warm blanket of world to crawl.
Right. And everybody's getting all the references. It doesn't. Whereas, you know, if you do know a lot about, you know, Westerosi religion and then you go into the Temple of Black and White and you recognize, oh, they've got little totems of all the different gods from around Westeros like that. And the show is every scene has a thing like that.
And that
really rewards your patience and rewards your close attention.
Yeah.
And
And it's easy to focus on when we're talking about the show, because obviously the book's around from 1996. And I was like you. I had heard about them. I had some employees of mine at the time as the show was ramping up. And I think it was going into production and they were talking. They were reading the books. They were waiting for the fifth book. Right. And in the back of my head, I was like, I don't even know. Like, what are they talking about? And I'm the nerdiest of the nerds. But even I was like, man, talking about knights and kings and seven kingdoms. Sure, I don't know what's going on there. And, you know, I feel stupid. I feel like I missed the boat early on. But I'm also not that kind of reader. I read historical biographies. I got books on Wyatt Earp. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then the show comes out and, look, we can point to the dragons, the sex and the sex position and all the sexy things and the violence and all these things that make sense to me on paper. Yeah, this show would work. But really, what you're describing, the first four or five episodes, they didn't have these big battles. It was all dialogue and politics, scheming and dreaming.
Yeah.
How did that work?
I don't really know. If I knew, I'd be creating my own Game of Thrones. They just balanced really well between giving you enough that was interesting, that was happening in real time, that you were like, this guy Ned Stark seems very conflicted and you know, there's a lot of depth going on. He's hacking people's heads off, but he's also a caring dad. You know, and I think that they gave you enough of that to where you kind of get pulled along. There's the mystery of what happened to John Arryn.
Yeah.
There's the friendship between King Robert and Ned. And, you know, I mean, Tyrion's a lot of fun to sort of follow around. You also get a little incest in there, episode one.
Good old-fashioned incest.
So I mean, they do use kind of the sexiness and the eroticism to kind of keep you. But no, I think that they it just balancing all of these different elements all at once is, you know, how they manage to sort of pull people in. I do think on one level, when you're talking about how did they immediately grab people, I do think part of that was that they cast it so well.
They really
and
did.
That Emilia Clarke and Peter Dinklage and, you know, some of these actors, Charles Dance, although he's not in it right away.
But he comes in later, episode seven.
But Kit Harington.
Yeah.
A lot of these, Sean Bean, obviously.
Yeah, he's
a lot. Yeah, a lot of these very likable people, very charismatic actors, and they're playing, you know, big roles.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it too, that more so than something like John from Cincinnati, this is like something big to latch onto that, like, well, this is costumes and it's elaborate and it's epic. I'm going to sort of give it more of a chance than maybe I would.
Yeah, I mean, this is the post Lord of the Rings world where Jackson comes in and faces some of the initial problems at New Line that I'm sure trying to get Game of Thrones off the ground
You
know, I will give you two movies. I think I need 10, but I'll take three.
Right.
And then you need these actors so well. It's still so well cast, even with, like, I'll say some of the smaller parts, the day players, the guest stars, the co-stars that come in for these episodes. I remember the one who, the old former slave turned, who's a teacher, who's like, comes to beg Danny, like, please let me go be a slave again because I had it good. That old guy is one of the best little performances. And he's got, that's it. That's a scene. And I think the show succeeds in that too, and it pulls you in. But we're in the pilot. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, one more thing I was going to say is, early on, too, I think one of the elements that really got me hooked was that it has a horror element. And I think that fantasy and horror, two great tastes that go great together, but we don't often see them combined.
Together at last.
Yeah, like it's Willow kind of plays with a little bit of that, and I really like how that movie does it. But yeah, I think and Conan, the Conan films sort of have occult side of things. But I think that, like, the very first scene of Game of Thrones is a White Walker scene. It's a scary zombie movie scene.
It absolutely is.
And I think that is a really key, like, you're going to get your romantic knights and tournaments and dragons and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also this grisly horror element to this.
It's a question we've either asked, whether it be on Watching Thrones, when I was hosting Talking Thrones on Collider, or Thrones Talk, whatever we called it.
Yeah.
Verbs and titles.
Yeah.
Casterly Talk is why it's such a great name. I always ask, you know, what hooked you? What hooked you in the moment? And that, for me, not knowing anything about this property, but knowing I'd seen like a teaser. I saw George R. R. Martin on set and just like, wow, this is coming together great. Mm-hmm. And Sean Bean, all right, I'm always like, Trevelyan, not Boromir. Trevelyan's in this movie, on this show. It is that opening scene because you have Waymer Royce going out there, Matt Damon Jr., as we call him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm already on board. Snow. Night Watchman, what is this thing? And then it scared me. Literally scared me.
I think with any property like this where it's historical, it's European, I think for Americans, you have to have that moment that lets Americans know, like, this isn't Merchant Ivory. I think Americans always go in and there's like 5% anxiety that the thing you're watching is going to become Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
And like everybody be like standing around in drawing rooms or like, and it is an example of my decadence. And like, I think
the hand of the king is here.
Yeah. And I think that Game of Thrones with it, a first few scenes, it's like there's zombies. Sean Bean's beheading a guy.
Yes.
There's wolves. We're bringing wolves back to the castle. I think they did a really good job of being like, this isn't Wolf Hall.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Yeah.
You're not going to need to know a lot about which one was Edward and which one was Henry.
Yeah.
And I think that went a long way, too, because a lot of British shows, I think they're great and Americans would like them if they could just get past the anxiety about.
I you know, it's so funny. Totally off. Have you ever watched The Detectorists? I think it's
I know what it. I haven't watched it.
And it's a great show, but it never moves past level one on the speed meter.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to like, took me a couple episodes to be like, oh, I need to readjust my laugh a minute meter.
Right. And Brits, they grow up with that BBC kind of content and they're just used to watching like literary adaptations or whatever. And they don't have that anxiety. They can just jump in. And it's like, oh, Howard's End. I'm in. This is great. And America's like, would it's not like they're dumber and wouldn't be capable of chamber dramas are great.
Yeah.
I think they just have that. There's that little like, oh, wait, did Oscar Wilde write this? Oh, everybody's in a top hat. You know, and it's just like too much wainscoting and they're out right away.
Everyone's in a top hat indeed. The first episode ends with a 10-year-old boy being pushed out of a tower.
Right.
And I think that's a great way to end it, too. But now you talked about being, you know, somewhat lost or worried.
I was lost through all of season one. I was almost done with season one.
Yeah.
I was on like episode 7 or 8. I think Ned Stark was like arrested.
Yeah, episode 7. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm not following this. I had a moment of realization of like, I'm very roughly following it. Like this guy, and he's rich and he lives in the north, and his friend is the king, and he came down to where the king lives, and now he's like caught up in all of this
drama.
Like I was that far.
Yeah.
But I just got that I wasn't getting into it enough. And I went back to the beginning and I rewatched the whole show up until that point. Okay. So by the time season one was over, like the finale of season one, I'd already seen the first season twice.
Wow, you'd gone back.
And that's what did it. Like, I really think to this day, if somebody is like, oh, yeah, I really like Game of Thrones, like, how many times have you watched each season? Because that second viewing of the episode is so important. If you can hear my voice right now and you like Game of Thrones, watch each episode twice.
It is fascinating to me. And look, I've watched episodes sometimes 4 times in one night. When we were doing Watching Thrones, you and I would watch the show in separate places, separate beds, because I'd be curled up in bed watching it.
Yeah. I'd be curled up at the foot of the bed.
Foot of the bed. 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
Yes, I was making producer notes, but you know, and I know not everyone has time for that. But I'm still surprised that some people who are like you said, oh, I love Game of Thrones. You know what? I finally watched the first season again. It's season 7 right now.
Yeah.
I started to understand things better. Like, it's how did you go through 7 seasons?
Oh, JTE got mad at me one day. It was this guy, we used to call him Handsome. His name's Ryan.
Ryan, we know Handsome.
So Handsome and JTE are in the studio setting up probably watching Thrones.
Barfing Thrones.
And I said, and I stand by this, they both got offended. If you haven't watched every episode of Game of Thrones twice, you aren't really following Game of Thrones. And I stand by that.
I stand by that too,
it's
sir.
It's too complicated. It's not like you're stupid.
Yeah.
It's nobody could follow it the way that it's meant to be followed with only one viewing. The thing I always come back to, the example that I like to use is the Blackfish.
Yes.
Now, by the time the Blackfish becomes a vital part of the story, you've met him like 4 times.
Right.
But he's never really registered.
Never registered.
It's like the Tullys. They're
Catelyn's
related.
Family, yeah.
They're related to Ned's wife.
Yeah.
They have a castle. I'm done with the fish. Their sigil is a fish.
I like fish.
I'm done with the Tullys forever. That's your mindset until you go back and start rewatching those episodes and mentally log like, oh, Brendan Tully.
Yeah.
We've now met. Oh, him again. We saw him last season. Now we see him again. He's probably an important figure.
He's
should keep in mind. And then when he does become a central character and enter and his sacrifice sort of becomes crucial, it's so much, the payoff is so much more
because
you've seen the steps and you've gotten to know him and you know where how other people think of him and where he is in relation to all the other people in this world.
I think there's, when you rewatch, there's like 2 different directions to go. And I think you need to go both directions when you rewatch it, which is one, you rewatch it to go back and kind of learn all the histories that they mention. You know, there's things being dropped. And obviously, if you read the books, the prophecies get so deep, and they're both. They're about the future, but they're also about the past. And so I love getting wrapped up in the past. We're going to talk about the Age of Heroes at the end of this episode here, about the prequel series and all that stuff. But so I think go that. And then you can watch it to pick up on what you think's going to happen in the future and get kind of locked into that story. It is kind of, you got to put a little bit of effort into it.
But people
have done that.
It's a good amount of effort, but I think the payoff is... The payoff is significant enough that it's worth it to put in that amount of effort, even though it's a fictional world that does not actually impact you in any real way.
It seems as though it does at times.
But I do think it's worth the hard work because they have put in enough really thoughtful, clever connections between everything. And it is really satisfying when you can sort of see things coming. Like, we used to, before this most recent season, we were already kind of clued into, like, well, the Brotherhood without Banners,
yeah,
they're going to come back and be a vital link.
Because there's kinda, something there.
Right, yeah. Well, the Lord of Light and the connection between them and Melisandre, and the show kind of tipped its hat to all that stuff.
Yeah.
But not if you were watching casually. There's no way.
Oh, there's no way. There's no way.
You wouldn't have even known mm-hmm. Beric Dondarrion. Wouldn't have even been able to spot him in a crowd.
Well, yes, he was recast, but that's also one of my favorite little things of... to someone who hasn't really watched the show, but is a fan. And again, we're talking to because you might just not connect to the show. That's different. But if you're listening to Casterly Talk,
baseline, you like the show.
It is Beric Dondarrion because you go back to season one, mm-hmm. different actor, but Ned sends him out.
Yeah.
And that
says the name.
Underrated. It's under the radar.
Yeah.
Boop, gone. And we meet him again.
There's so many mm-hmm. that it's just going back and rewatching. That's the only way to do it. You could have charts and there's mm-hmm. no like one page of the Westeros dictionary right. you can look at that makes all these connections. You just gotta watch
and sometimes it's the map, and I'm a sucker for maps. Now I love like Lord of the Rings maps, you know, I'll look at that. Star Wars is not, you know, it's different to map it out, but there's galaxy maps.
Sure.
So I'll be like, ooh, that planet's close to, and I love that, and I love histories because I am a history buff myself. So this show taps into that for me. So I'm hooked from the White Walkers in the beginning, and the rest is just me connecting to it in that kind of way. But I think with the theme song, the opening sequence, I think it deserves a lot of credit because you're humming it. The world is humming it, but you're also learning as you go there too. And I think that helped pull some people.
Oh,
in.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's always a fun moment. It was sometime in the first season when you realize like, oh, the map in the beginning actually links up to the locations we're going to visit that week. It's not random. Like, I kind of thought they had three and they were just playing them. It's like, oh, no, we go to the wall this week. So in the same way, there was just, I think it might have been The Vulture. One of the blogs just did a really good piece about how we don't really ever think about previously on, but how much that shapes your expectations of what you're about to watch.
Right.
You know, like when you're like previously on The Walking Dead, and then you see a Morgan scene and your brain registers like Morgan's going to be the main character this week. And like we interact with that so much without really thinking about it. And this is sort of another level of that. Like when you're watching the map in the beginning, you're already kind of thinking like, oh, interesting. Oh. Someone's going to Braavos this week. I wonder what, you're kind of already doing that.
And it was the season three premiere. I had a little premiere party at my house. And when the credits pop up, and you have, the cold open is, of course, with Jorah Mormont, Jorah Mormont mm-hmm. that season. But it goes to credits, and with Winterfell on fire.
Yeah.
Holy moly. That was.
Yeah, it really
we cheered.
Yeah, little change like that, but and then the same thing, like when people noticed that the lights at the Citadel resembled the sun from the opening. Yeah. Just like those little
details. Yeah. Now, with you being quote unquote lost in the middle and you take your time out and research there, what is there a specific thing outside of just your own personal, ooh, I'm starting to understand it? Was there a moment that you were like, I'm hooked, or was there a moment early on that you're like, I know I'm hooked on this show, but I want to give it its due by going back and researching it myself? You know what I'm saying? Like,
I mean, I think that by the end of season one, like by mm-hmm. the conclusion of season one, certainly the death of Ned Stark and the sort of shock moment of that, that was when I was like, all right, these guys are doing something interesting that is not expected. Because I still, you could watch a lot of season one and it's, the detail stands out and how thought out everything is. And, you know, sort of like much like when you study European history, like the dynasties and all the complexity of that. But I don't think I really realized until, the death of Ned Stark, like how much he was playing with the conventions of fantasy writing as a genre.
Oh, I think the nation mourned that day.
Yeah. That like
the next morning was sad.
It's not necessarily going to be these traditional setup payoffs mm-hmm. like you're sort of thinking. Maybe it is, but over the course of a decade instead of over the course of a season where you're used to, you know, like
the long play.
Well, yeah. I mean, because Sopranos, groundbreaking. I love the show. I am not here to knock Sopranos. I love it. Let's do a Sopranos podcast next.
Okay.
But Sopranos, you know, every season it's like we're getting introduced to a new guy. He's probably going to be a nemesis for Tony.
Right.
By the end of the season, this guy, you know, Joey Pants might not make it
right,
to the end of the season. We're going to have to figure out. And that became sort of the formula. And Game of Thrones just relentlessly refuses to do that. Yep. And I think once I got clued into, like, nope, we're not going to set up the villain that you love to hate, and then the season will end with the good guy chopping his head off.
Right.
Maybe that will happen sometimes.
Maybe.
Maybe that will not happen sometimes.
Yeah.
There's no way you're going to know. And I think that was what was really exciting. Like, I really have no idea what's coming next.
Everything's on the table, so to speak. Right. And I think as the show moves on, and I think we're seeing some of... I love season 7, but some of the fan reactions, you know, we're starting to get solutions. We're getting solutions now. And sometimes the solutions aren't the solutions we want, or it goes against what we learned from seasons 1 through 5.
Or it's just, it's a conclusion instead of a momentary situation. Like everything in Game of Thrones up until now has been like, well, the Starks are down, but not out, you know, like it's ongoing.
Yeah.
And I think now... there's inevitably going to be some level of disappointment of, like, some of these stories are ending.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Which I think, like, the Baelish one and everything. But we'll talk about that as Casterly Talk goes on. But, yeah, Oberyn Martell in season 4 is a great example of, by this time I had read ahead in the books, and so I knew it was coming. But I was, you know, watching with people who didn't. And I wasn't doing the videotaping them type of thing there. I'm sure it could have got a million views. But, you know, I wanted to let them experience it. And I'll tell you, they were, even with Ned Stark going, you know, even with...
Yeah.
Stannis not winning the throne, which is, I think, against the stories we might be. We're used to, whether you like Stannis or not, he's going to King's Landing. The Lannisters, the bad guys, he's going to, oh, he lost. So all this stuff happens. And then season 4, Oberyn comes in, and it's like the same thing happens again. We're like, no. But it bucks the tradition.
In that case, they did such a good job of making it unthinkable that he would lose. Like, because we love this character, Pedro Pascal can't get written off the show after just one season.
Right.
It would be the death of Tyrion, another beloved character who we think has plot armor and can't die. Everyone hates the Mountain. Nobody wants to see the Mountain win a huge victory. So there's so much stacked into, like, well, maybe they'll come up with some way to make it surprising, but we all know who's going to win this fight. And then to go the other way and just crush... everyone's dreams along with a skull.
Could it be then that to answer our topic here, our big question of what makes the show work, could it be, Lon, that we just are addicted to the heartbreak?
Yeah, I mean, I think unpredictability goes a hugely long way, certainly with me.
Yeah.
And I think I think with a lot of audiences too, if you can, after 7 seasons, it's a really hard thing to do, after 7 seasons, to really keep people guessing. And I'll point to another show. I've used it as an example already. Not a bad show. I don't mean to be doing the good show versus bad show.
Sure.
But The Walking Dead, another show that's been on for a very long time, like Game of Thrones, but has kind of fallen into a little bit of repetitiveness, a little bit of like, well, I kind of get I get how these seasons are organized. And when the season opens and Rick is, we don't know exactly where in the timeline he is. Yeah. We don't know exactly what he's talking about. But when he's like, my love won over my wrath, you're like, I bet I know what he's talking about. Okay. And you kind of get there.
Right.
And there's no chance with Game of Thrones.
And
I think that really does at this, when you're talking about this level of longevity, I think that's very important.
I think it is. I think it is. We might not be the scientists needed to answer this great question of what hooks you into Game of Thrones, but there's definitely some reasons there. And, you know, we'll see if season 8 comes on and the conclusions of all conclusions falls into our laps as fans. We'll see what that does to us as well. But we're going to keep going on here on Casterly Talk. More in a bit.
HBO's Game of Thrones is now a certified hit that helped change the landscape of television. But the first attempt at the pilot episode was a disaster. The failed first pilot is now part of Game of Thrones lore among fans. Originally shot in 2009, under the direction of Tom McCarthy, the first attempt at the episode titled Winter is Coming fell flat, and 90% of the episode was reshot. The two biggest changes were prominent recastings. The role of Daenerys Targaryen was originally played by the Tudors actor Tamsin Merchant, and the Tony Award-winning Jennifer Ely played Catelyn Stark. Also, a cameo from George R.R. Martin as an attendee of the Daenerys Targaryen Khal Drogo wedding was also cut due to the reshoots. Co-creator David Benioff said that the process of making the first pilot was a deeply humiliating, painful experience, and admitted that one key plot point was accidentally excluded from the first script. It was never established that Jaime and Cersei Lannister were siblings. The reshoot pilot aired in April 2011, and nearly 7 million fans watched it during that first week.
All right, back in studio here on Casterly Talk. I'm Ken Namtuk. I'm here with Lon Harris.
We forgot to mention butts. Go back. The last, like, why did Game of Thrones take off? Butts. Very attractive butts.
That'll work every time.
I mean, both genders. All over. Just a ton of butts all over.
Wolf butt, too. It's all there.
Maybe the best butt show in TV.
I would say so.
NYPD Blue had that very famous on-screen butt, but it was just the one.
Could you imagine if Dennis Franz jumps over to Game of Thrones? That could work.
Yes.
Cast him secretly in season 8. So season 8 is, you know,
one Jersey guy.
Like,
where did this?
He's doing his Carmine character from Die Hard 2. That would be great.
I love that.
Season 8 is going to be here faster than we know it. It's been a long wait, I know, but we're going to have the show Game of Thrones wrapping up. But Lon, that's not going to be it for Game of Thrones on HBO.
Certainly not.
No surprise to anyone here. We're going to get the prequel series, and we knew there was always talk for, I think, from about season 5, season 6, people started to wonder. You know?
Right. Yeah, but I love what they did. I love the announcement that they made, because I think that so many of us assumed that it was going to be Robert's Rebellion,
right?
Which is the natural. I like this a lot better, but that seems like the natural thing you do. You could cast younger versions of a lot of the characters. Ned Stark coming back, Robert Baratheon coming back.
Yep.
Like, I was so sure. I was so sure that's what they were going to do.
When I first started hearing the whispers, it made sense. Even after you saw the flashback scenes that started popping up there. What was that, season 6? They started really popping up there, and in the young Ned Stark and all that stuff. Because again, hey, you like this stuff, we're going to give you this, characters you know.
Right, they're always so scared to do that. It's a totally different era, so they can't, you know, they want to do the Star Wars. They want to be like, Chewie can show up.
Right, you got to know. You know these characters, you're comfortable.
Exactly.
So I was thinking, but then word started coming out. George R. Martin says, we're not going to do Robert's Rebellion. I've already told much of that story in the books, therefore in the show.
Right.
The story's already been told, and I even heard that and was like, I understand. But it is money and business we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, well, what prequels have ever come out where we didn't know any of the story? Like, we knew what happened to Anakin Skywalker, too.
Yeah, so then word comes out that five different prequel pilots and concepts are being worked on. George R. R. Martin had his hands in all of them. And then Brian Cogman, current writer, known as kind of the lore and book guy on the show's writing staff now, he has a series, and I thought whatever that one was going to be the winner. But no, we end up going with the Age of Heroes seems to be emerged as the favorite of the prequel series we're going to get. Now, Lon, on the show Casterly Talk, with the help of others like Rachel Cushing and Michelle Boyd, we'll go into the Age of Heroes and what it really means. But we got some research. We know a little bit about it. Where do you think the show will go? Where do you think it starts? What do we think? Age of Heroes.
Well, Age of Heroes, I mean, the event that it includes that we've heard a lot about is the Long Night. So this is the era when the original war between the sort of at that point, the First Men and the White Walkers happened. So like before the Age of Heroes is when the Children of the Forest create the first White Walker. We've actually seen that in Game of Thrones. Right. That's even before the Age of Heroes.
Character of Leaf would be there.
So the Age of Heroes sort of kicks off when the war between the Children of the Forest and the First Men ends.
Right.
They form an alliance. Mm-hmm. And then I believe 1,000 years or so after that, that's when the Long Night and the battle against the White Walkers happens.
So
it seems like that would be a natural thing to lead into.
Yeah, which is you got 1,000 years. What do you do? You know, that's fun to play with. But it's also it's a interesting bookend to me when I thought about it that way, because I didn't put any money down on it at Vegas, but my choice was Age of Heroes. So I was very publicly happy when this came out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dance with Dragons, Blackfyre Rebellions, those dragons, those Targaryens, get it. The Aegon's Conquest is fascinating.
Sure.
And I'm sure that was kicked around, but they had released that 45-minute animated faux documentary they do.
I also feel like Game of Thrones is so good at the lead up to war, and that's just like a war story. I mean, battle after battle, and the dragons just burning down the entire continent.
Yeah, and you kind of, again, kind of know right. where it's going. If you're a fan of any, you know, average level, and you've read enough of them, or you've gone to the wikis and done your research there. But yeah. Once I really kind of thought about, the Age of Heroes ends, whether or not we covered 1,000 years on the show doesn't matter. It ends with the Long Night, something we're familiar with, the others, the White Walkers, Azor Ahai, sure. all these things. And then we pick it up in Game of Thrones, and that's where it kind of picks up again, is the White Walkers have returned.
Right.
So it's something we're familiar with. You can bookend the series in that way,
yes.
Or at least their fandom there. So I think it's a great starting
point. It's also a narrative that, I mean, if we do talk about the construction of the wall, the
yes.
sort of first men really taking on the fight against the White Walkers, that's when you start to talk about these characters who are the ancestors to
yeah.
our characters. And I do think Bran the Builder, you know, the original Lannisters, like, I don't think they're going to be able to resist the thrall of pulling them in.
It's too interesting. Some of the names that are, you know, featured here, you got Duron, Godsgrief, Bran the Builder, which is, of course, Bran Stark,
mm-hmm.
Lan the Clever, who takes Casterly Rock yeah. from the Casterlys, the Grey King, Garth Greenhand.
And House, Lan the Clever, Lannister.
Lannister, yeah. House Gardener, which eventually is wiped clean, and House Tyrell takes over the
Highgarden,
yeah. all that stuff. Stuff, and others down the line there.
I don't think they're going to be able to resist bringing us some of these characters
right.
because it's going to be so fun to see the formation of these great houses that we've been following.
A lot of fun. Yeah,
I had pitched on TV Fights. Little side trip. I think it was TV Fights, or maybe it was Movie Fights. We were doing a Harry Potter fight, and the question was sort of like, what would be the best Harry Potter prequel?
Yeah.
And I had a very sort of similar concept, which would be the formation of Hogwarts.
You
want to see Godric Gryffindor and Rowena Ravenclaw, and you were like, we've been hearing so much about these like epic mythic figures. You'd want to see them together actually making the school.
And it works. It works for me more than seeing young Robert Baratheon.
Right,
or
because
young
we sort of already had a chance to do a show about them. And these are, we know them only by reputation, only by their deeds.
Yeah.
We don't know anything about them. And yet we do, because they're Starks and Lannisters and Targaryens. Although that's another interesting thing I wanted to get into.
Yeah.
One thing I read on Wikia.
Ooh.
I've moved my eyebrows up. Was that this is, again, this is George R. R. Martin playing very much into like real history.
Right.
This is sort of Westeros's Bronze Age because the Andals, you know, Queen of the Andals,
they
haven't come to Westeros.
They haven't arrived yet.
So it's sort of like an Angles meet the Saxons sort of deal.
Yep.
So this is, it's almost like comparing like if Game of Thrones is sort of like King Arthur, like high medieval fantasy. This is almost like our Bronze Age. Like this is Beowulf.
Yes.
And so to explore that, like this is before knights and courtliness and all of that. It's not really going to be swords. It's much more primitive.
And the building of these castles, we eventually know.
I was looking into this too, because this was so fascinating to me. Like even that, like what we think of as like the classic medieval castle building style that we know from Game of Thrones.
Right.
Even that is
different. Yeah.
Post-dated. This is like Moat Cailin, like those little ring castles. Like that's this era. So that's what the fortifications are going to look like. Stuff like that is so nerdy and cool to me.
And fascinating.
If you can, you know, like we're going to take a look at this totally different sort of period in Westeros history and look at all the different ways it's going to filter out and make like day-to-day life different. Even then, you know, it'll still be diplomacy and castles and war and, you know, all that stuff is still happening.
No Targaryens, no dragons.
Right. Well, they haven't come over to Westeros.
So that'll be interesting too, is if dragons are your pool, this might be a problem.
Or do we sort of
play around with it?
Yeah, I think
because Valyria is going on.
It exists, right. So I think that you can fudge the, like, we may not have, because if you are talking but if you're talking about medieval history and record keeping in Game of Thrones, it's not going to be perfect or exact. It's entirely possible historical events happen that the maesters of Game of Thrones era don't have record of.
Yeah, the Doom of Valyria has not happened yet, and you just touched upon something that I was going to get to, and it's very important, because if you watch the Histories and Lore video of the Age of Heroes, Isaac Hempstead White is the VO, and he's very young, so it might be on the season 1 or season 2
disc. Way back.
It's about 2.5 minutes. You can find them on YouTube, but you know, grab the DVDs, Blu-rays, and watch them there. They're great stuff if you haven't watched the history and lore videos. He's talking about the Age of Heroes, and he says, in short, I'm paraphrasing, that he goes, because he goes through Bran the Builder, Lan the Clever, all these things. These are all mysteries and fairy tales, so we don't know if they're true.
Right.
But every, and he says this line exactly, but every one of the seven kingdoms is defined by them.
Yeah.
And that is the heart of the show.
Yeah.
How is there, did the Grey King really fight a mermaid or marry, you know, the Storm's End? Was it really a magic curse, you know, all that stuff.
And what's so great about that is that it's 100% true and accurate to real Earth history. Like I mentioned, Beowulf was written, you know, like several hundred years after it's set by Christians who were writing about a like pre-Christian pagan society. So they're making up myths about their history that are now our history of them. And like, it's in the same way. It's going to be, we've heard about the Age of Heroes from characters at a different point in Westeros history, but they're benighted. They don't know. They're listening to the old guys in the Citadel with the robes who are pulling the random scrolls. And those guys that we've seen are very fallible.
Yep.
So I love
almost that they like to control the narrative.
Right. So I love that idea that, well, there really isn't anything to say that we couldn't have dragons in this show. We totally could, we will probably, I sense that one thing they will do that would be really fun is to show us quote unquote real events that happened in the Age of Heroes that became mythologized by the time we get to Game of Thrones.
What I love about Game of Thrones, especially season one, and by the end where we are at with season seven, is magic is coming back. It doesn't exist in this world, season one, season two. You know, the warlocks of Karth are just getting their powers back because Dany's dragons are returned. So magic returns as fans who maybe aren't high fantasy magic kind of fans start to get used to it. They start to go back. So
it's also a very Tolkien.
It's Tolkien,
idea,
yeah.
That like the magic is sort of seeped out of the world, but then Sauron's return kind of
brings it back in. And so I like playing with that. Which also going back to what you're saying is, we might see the normal things of what's going on, what Lan the Clever is doing, or how the Greyjoys became the Greyjoys. But then I have to imagine there is some magic there that will confirm some of the legends, which will be part of the fun for me as well. I want the wall to be of magic. And we see what happens in the end now at the end of season seven, but I want there to be a Horn of Joramun connected to this wall and the giants and all these and magic holding it together.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, right. And that's going to be,
we don't know what it will be.
Right. Yeah. And that I think is going to be the fun of going back so far into history is that, they get to really rewrite it on the fly.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of concrete. Like if you're doing Robert's Rebellion, there's a lot of concrete stuff you kind of have to do. You know,
you can fudge with the margins, and having George R. R. Martin involved with it is very interesting to me. So as we round the corner on this conversation here, in terms of the actual show and how you approach it and the stories you tell, again, we got 1,000 years we're playing with here. I don't know which direction I want to go. I don't know if I want it to be closer to the Long Night or following the pact with the children. That's a long time.
Right. That's what I mean. And honestly, for the first season, if it's in keeping with Game of Thrones, we may still not really even have this answer. Like, we'll know, okay, it's about these three or four families or people living in this region of Westeros. Because that's the other thing is I'm not up enough on my Westerosi history to know this, but basically the first men became the Northerners.
Yes, yes.
I don't think we're gonna be getting down south very well. We probably won't be spending a lot of time in King's Landing, Highgarden, Dorne. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if the first men made it that far.
Well,
south.
Yeah, and King's Landing came more out of Aegon's conquest and all that kind of stuff.
So that would have been like a little port or whatever, not really even a settlement at this point.
I mean, Highgarden, it's all on the table, but you're right. The things even then that we don't know, King's Landing couldn't even be mentioned. And you know what it was before.
Or like Moat Cailin in the Neck might be the south. And that's like as far south as it goes. So, I mean, I think that stuff is really fascinating. And you know, I think we'll probably be exploring the north more as like the centerpiece of the show.
Right. Because
that was where the first men were living. We also, at this point in history, I believe first men, wildlings, it's all one
It's
big
all one kind of crazy
group.
Thing. Yeah.
So that's another sort of big picture theme that might emerge over the course of this show is the drawing apart of those communities and how the sort of Westerosi became mm-hmm. the Westerosi versus how the Wildlings became the Wildlings.
Well, yeah, we always hear, hey, those Wildlings, those free folk just happened to be born on the wrong side of a wall after it was put up. They can play around with that idea.
Right, which is also a very, like, that would be the conventional idea among yep. the people, like, well, they're on the wrong side of the wall, but obviously there's more.
Yeah, more to it, more to yeah. it. Do you feel, and this is, you know, all these are tough questions to answer. We're just speculating here wildly. Do you need a center family or house like we have with Starks? Is Bran the Builder that guy? Do you think it needs to focus on that, or do you feel you just it's the land and the world itself? I think this time around
you're gonna have to zero in on some people for us to root for and against. Mm-hmm. And I mean the conventional traditional idea would be Bran the Builder would mm-hmm. We love the Starks in Game of Thrones. We want to keep loving more Starks. that's the definite play it safe. Yeah. But we do know that George R. R. Martin does not like to do that.
Yeah.
I think it would be very Martin-esque to center this show around a house we maybe don't like from the, like yeah. if the Lannisters are the really
imagine that. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be great if the Lannisters are the really likable, compelling people, charismatic house in this one, and the Starks are, you know, like you can do that sort of stuff. Like it's not, you know, there's no mm-hmm. rules about mm-hmm. which houses are have to be our heroes. But I do think on some level you're gonna have to stake out some heroes and villains, right. just like the new show has. Otherwise it's just too We need something to grab on to.
Wild speculation.
And we need a looming threat, so it'll be either...
I don't know if the Long Night is that looming threat, because I have to research a little bit.
Probably not, because they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know you're in the Long Night until you're in it.
Yeah, exactly.
So...
giant ice spiders coming down. Thanks, Nan. The looming threat and, you know, wild speculation time. It's like, does Bran Stark that we know now, the you know, who becomes the three-eyed raven, is he Bran the Builder, that wild theory? I don't think so. I'd never bought into that. But it's like, is it connected in that kind of way? Was George going to reveal that? Do you even want something like that?
I don't think, like, we'll have Isaac Hampstead Wright play Bran the Builder, or the same dude. Like, right. I don't think they're going to go that far, but I absolutely think he's already baked in a way to interact the two series.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think there's any resisting the idea that these two worlds can communicate through this one force,
It will be interesting to see if, you know, with George R. R. Martin kind of in the early development process, and then HBO and their producers take their hands on it there. And who is it? Is it Jane?
Yes. Jane. It's a woman named Jane Esperson. I don't want to mangle her last name.
Is it Jane Goodall?
No. She's the primatologist.
You're right. Yeah. But it's something similar to that.
It might be kind of like a Goodall, but it is not Jane Goodall.
Yeah. I'm typing up in a now.
She's the one who, like, she touches the chimp's hand. And
yes, that's right.
That's Jane Goodall.
As I looked that up, though, how much do you think Jane Goldman?
Jane Goldman.
We want to give her the credit she deserves.
Nice Jewish girl, and I couldn't remember her name.
She's running this pilot. They're working with George. So, do you think, I mean, how connected, other than the worlds and the brand stuff aside, it's obviously going to have its own identity, but do you have the look and the feel? How much do you want it to just feel like the same show?
I'd love for them to. I think the fact that this is taking place in Westeros, mm-hmm. it's a Game of Thrones spinoff, to me, that's enough. Other than that, I would love, as much as they can, for them to go their own way. And that's why I think, like I was bringing up the Bronze Age versus the medieval, like that's why that's so exciting to me on some levels. Mm-hmm. Like, they really can't just kind of revert back to doing Game of Thrones mm-hmm. because the society wasn't really there.
They can't use the same sets, the same castle sets. They can't.
Yeah, well, but it's even like the culture, because the Andals, again, are like they're the ones bringing sort of the chivalrous, the more sort of sophisticated, the cosmopolitan. Yep. They're right, the Faith of the Seven is the Andals. So you're really talking more about, it's like every stereotype that Southerners in Game of Thrones have about Northerners in Game of Thrones, that they're this kind of like rough warrior, sort of brutish, like they live in this
boring,
sort of
drab,
really, harsh landscape or whatever. It's dull.
Yeah.
Like, that's the society that we're going to.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different, it's more like, you know, Viking culture mm-hmm. almost in some ways. So you really can't, they have to kind of do something totally new. They can't fall back too much on their, rest on their laurels and make it too similar, because it's thousands of years before.
Which is why I love it as an idea and why I think it really works as a prequel idea. I'm very curious of what else was in the works.
Oh, yeah. Eventually, I'm sure we'll have to get all the info on here's all the different
and maybe,
things they were planning.
You know, maybe another one pops up. One in the summer, one series in the winter. I don't know.
Why not, right?
Two Game of Thrones series a year, not bad.
There have been times in history where there were two Star Trek shows on TV at one time.
We can relive that.
So why not?
Why not?
There's precedent already.
As we close here, Lon, thoughts on what might have the other ones have been? We know Robert's Rebellion wasn't on the table.
I absolutely think like Doom of Valeria and the Targaryen invasion of Westeros must have been appealing. I also feel like I would love to think about the future. I would love to hear about what's 100 years beyond the War of the Five Kings, because we know from European history it's not like it slowed down and nothing else exciting happened.
Right.
Kept being very exciting.
When's the first car in Westeros? We get that episode.
I mean, that, like, I love thinking about stuff like that. Like, how far could you take it before it really, like, could we get to the Renaissance of Game of Thrones era? And then could we get to the age of Game of Thrones Enlightenment? And, you know.
The Battlestar Galactica ending there. They end up, you know, back in time.
But, I mean, I really do think, like, you could very easily, based on the raw materials you already have from Game of Thrones, they have set up like the next generation. Like you could definitely have done a sequel series.
And I'm very curious that also will tie into how season 8 ends and the story ends, what's left in Westeros there.
Liana Mormont as a grown woman would be quite a character.
I'd follow that series right there, right now. I think the Blackfyre Rebellion, it's a lot of that kind of stuff, but then tantalizing because George R. R. Martin kept kind of hinting that there's some times and eras that we weren't really familiar with, you know?
Well, sure. I mean, and that's, again, true of medieval history. You know, if you think about, like, they knew a lot about, like, the Greeks and the Romans. Mm-hmm. And not much. They didn't have good records. So we could, there could totally be only a few hundred years before the action that we're seeing, and it's events that they don't really know much about. Plus, the show has still left huge pockets unexplored.
Yeah.
Like the Tarleys. I mean, like
the Tarleys.
We don't know anything about the Tarleys or Horn Hill or that whole. There's large pockets of land we've never been to.
I want a series on the Summer Isles. And, you know, the Shadow by a Shy, by the Shadow, I should say. Yeah, there's a lot there intentionally, I think, left blank. Page,
I mean, I feel like
blank.
That may be stuff they're leaving for other. Yeah. Series.
We
may not
books.
Ever get to a Shy.
And we may never get the book series actually ending because George is busy. Come on, George. Well, we'll find out soon. It's wide open territory with the Age of Heroes and what that show might be. So we had some fun speculating. What do you guys think? Let us know. Use the hashtag CasterlyTalk and pitch your Age of Heroes show to us here on Casterly Talk. It's going to be a fun wait to season 8 and a fun wait to Age of Heroes. We'll get through it together. That is the first episode of Casterly Talk. Lon, thanks so much for making this happen here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, thanks
it's
for having
always
me.
Fun talking with you. Tell them where they can follow you and pitch their own show ideas.
Follow me on Twitter at LONS. 4 letters. Gotta love it. And sign up for my newsletter. I write a newsletter about streaming TV and movies for a company called Inside. We cover Game of Thrones along with everything else that's on your Netflix, your Hulus, your YouTubes even. Inside.com/streaming. That's where to sign up for that. It's free. I send it out twice a week.
I love it. Sign up. Follow Lon. Lons is the best branding on Twitter.
LONS, right? Not bad.
That's it. All right. More Casterly Talk after this.
Hi, everybody. I'm Thomas Risling, and welcome to Ruminations from the Realm. Today, what I wanted to talk about is the idea of how hardship is used in Game of Thrones, specifically from the point of view of each character. And even more specifically, I guess, how the immediate loss of a character's strongest trait or ability is often used by the writers to force an immediate evolution or adaptation from that character as a coping or survival mechanism. Now, I mean, this is done repeatedly with a myriad of characters from Game of Thrones, but the one that I want to use today as an example for discussion is Jaime Lannister. When we first meet Jaime Lannister, you know, he's the Kingslayer. He's brash, he's arrogant, he's the son of a rich lord, a well-known rich lord. He's wearing gilded armor, he's got his cape, he's the best swordsman in the Seven Kingdoms. He sleeps with his sister, and he uses all of those facts to murder and intimidate, often and pretty much without any kind of hesitation or remorse. But when Jaime loses his sword hand, the hand that arguably made him who he is, or who he believes himself to be, and us as the viewers and readers, I think at this point, we also believe that sword hand to be a huge part of who Jaime is. When he loses that hand, he is forced into a state of change, or adaptation if you will, where he has to adapt to survive. He still is pretty horrible when he first loses his hand, but slowly, he does begin to change. And it's that turn from kind of pure evil to seeing the error of some of his ways is why many of us are starting to see Jaime as a bit of a protagonist. He's starting to make decisions for the right. He's making those decisions because he's seen so much of this repetitive pattern from people like Cersei and his father and Tyrion. I mean, maybe less so Tyrion, but still, Cersei and his father the most, and even Robert to some extent, and the Mad King before him. These patterns, he's watched people fail in these patterns of complacency and comfortability. And what he seems to be forced into doing by losing his hand is evolving through what would have been his version of that complacency. And we end up with a character that many of us now, as I said before, now kind of feel attached to. I don't want bad to happen to Jaime Lannister at this point. Spoilers, if you're not caught up with the series, I'm assuming at this point you should be. Jaime Lannister leaves. I mean, we are yet to fully have confirmation of where he's going. One would assume Winterfell, or whatever part of North he'll get to before the impending doom meets him first. But he's leaving. He's leaving behind everything he's known and everything he's built his character around, because as he has changed after losing his hand, so too has the way he sees his environment. And all of the things that contributed to his complacency, to that kind of abhorrent behavior that he so often flaunted, has changed, and he doesn't see the same value in it. Yes, the impending doom is one thing, but if you put that aside and just think from a character perspective, this is a man who has been forced to go through some extreme change and some extreme loss in a very short period of time, and it forced him to become a better person and to grow as a person. Now, whether you like Jaime or not, that's, you know, that's whatever, but I mean, you can't deny that Jaime as a person throughout the arc in the books and show has grown. And I think the one thing that we can all take from this is the idea that hardship, if we don't force ourselves to continually adapt and change and grow within ourselves in our own lives, these hardships will just get dropped at our doorstep and force us to make these changes, whether we like it or not. And no one needs that. We're all capable of making those changes and forcing positive change in our own lives. We just have to commit to it. And sometimes that's easier said than done, I know. But we can all do it. And this is the message that I took from this. So, thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Ken, for giving me the platform to share these thoughts. I hope you enjoyed the first episode of Ruminations from the Realm.
Thank you, Thomas. Ruminations from the Realm will be a regular segment here on Casterly Talk. That's our pilot episode. For more information on how to help me build the show, go to patreon.com/thenapsackfiles. Casterly Talk will be back.
Thanks for listening to Casterly Talk. Like our page on Facebook and join the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag Casterly Talk.